Please open your Bibles to the book of Romans tonight, chapter 2, as we look at verses 21 through 24. These verses demonstrate to us that practice fails to show perfect. In Romans chapter 2, verses 17 through 20, you will remember we have a long Greek sentence, and it began with the word if, back in verse 17, which was a first-class condition. That is, an if describing something which is actually true. It is actually the case. In this long part of this conditional sentence, where Paul is establishing the condition, he lists several things which are true about a certain category of humanity. That is, the person who is religious but is lost. The unsaved religious person. He uses the Jew as an example of this type of person. He is very religious. He is very zealous. He is very confident of his relationship to God, but he's on the way to the lake of fire. Now, in this first part of the conditional sentence, Paul has pointed out several things which were true about the Jew. For example, he points out that he bears the racial name Jew, which marks him as part of God's chosen earthly people. That he relied upon the mere possession of the law, revelation from God for salvation. That he gloried in his special relationship to the true God in contrast to the inane relationships of the heathen about him to the false gods. That he claimed an understanding of God's will in various matters because he had the scripture. That he claimed to have a keen sense of moral discernment. He could tell you what was right and what was wrong morally, what pleased God and what didn't. He considered himself a guide to those who were spiritually blind. He considered himself a source of divine viewpoint light to those who were in human viewpoint darkness. He was a corrector of those who were spiritually foolish. He knew when somebody was spiritually out of line and felt fully qualified to correct them. And he was, as a matter of fact, in his eyes, a teacher of the spiritually immature. He was finally the very embodiment of divine viewpoint knowledge, the embodiment of Bible knowledge and of God's truth. He was the epitome of understanding concerning what God thought and what pleased God. Now, all of these things, one by one, have been listed in this long sentence, verse 17 through verse 20. And all of these things, in a certain degree, were true. This is how the Jew did look at himself, and he did have a certain area of qualification for these things which he claimed. Now, with this long conditional part of the sentence established, you can see that the religious unbelieving Jew is a very confident person. At the end of verse 20, you will notice in your English translation that there just is a line, just a dash. And this is the translator's way of trying to convey something that's in the Greek grammar, which is that Paul has been writing along this line, and suddenly he makes a very dramatic shift. Grammatically, in Greek grammar, this is called an anokaluthon, which means that he stops one grammatical form, which here was the conditional sentence, and he just starts all over again. Now that's a dramatic way, an emphatic way of pointing out something that he wants to say. So the translators try to convey that just by showing you a dash that, bingo, the sentence just ends up hanging in the air, and what should follow normally to finish the conditional sentence doesn't follow. But in effect, from verses 21 through 24, we do have the conclusion of the conditional sentence, but not in its normal sense. It does make it stand out, however, by doing it this way. Paul is going to build something now upon all these things that are really true about the Jew. So he proceeds to show, beginning at verse 21, that the religious Jew violates the very expression of divine righteousness which he indeed possessed in the Mosaic Law. That the Jew, who had all these qualities in some degree true about himself that had been listed, nevertheless, he failed of salvation. He still did not gain eternal life through these things. So what the religious unbeliever takes pride in, the thing he is trusting in for salvation, is mere religion, and it's unacceptable to God. Now the Jew thought he was headed for heaven. He thought he was saved. So the Spirit of God, in a very clever way, led Paul to subtly raise doubts in the mind of the religious unbelieving Jew concerning his own confident relationship to God. So all the religious unbeliever has here, at best, is legalism. And legalism is doomed to hell. With all of its zeal, with all of its confidence, with all of its religious activity, legalism will never get a person to heaven. So we pick it up at verse 21, where Paul says, "Thou therefore who teachest another." The word therefore is the Greek word oun, O-U-N. It introduces the result of the facts that have been listed for us in verses 17 through 20. Now, on the basis of this, Paul with this word begins the conclusion. It isn't the normal way to begin the second part of a conditional sentence, but he begins it this way and calls thereby special attention to what he's going to say. Who teaches? It's the Greek word didasko, D-I-D-A-S-K-O. Didasko refers to the religious Jew as an instructor of the information that was contained in the Mosaic Law. He was that. He did explain to people what the Mosaic Law had to teach. It is present tense, which indicates that he was constantly ready to give you information about what was in the law. It is active because he himself was the teacher. It is a participle, which indicates to us that a principle is being stated here, namely that the religious Jew was a teacher. He was somebody who was ready to discuss God and to tell you what he believed, what he understood, what he was confident of concerning God. Now it says that he is teaching another, and this is the Greek word heteros, H-E-T-E-R-O-S. Now heteros is the Greek word for another, which means another of a different kind. The implication here is that one kind of person, called a teacher, is teaching another kind of person that is a pupil. Now there's a vast difference between a teacher and a pupil. When a teacher walks into the classroom under God's divine order, that teacher carries authority. He is the authority in the classroom. The pupil who sits before him has no authority at all. The pupil may have certain rights. The teacher can't hit him over the head when he doesn't learn. The teacher can't kick him around or abuse him. The teacher shouldn't even abuse him verbally. But the pupil has no authority. The pupil has no word as to what is going to be taught in that classroom. The pupil has no say-so about that whatsoever. Now, of course, you have heard a lot of that violated in recent years, where you have the grotesque sight of students in college classrooms who are insisting that they should have a right on what they are taught, instead of insisting that the authority lies in the teacher, and if they don't like what they're being taught, to go someplace else and learn what they want to learn. Turning a college over to students, or any school over to students, to have a direction of the institution is like turning an insane asylum over to the inmates. You get about the same results. Now, this word is making a point. Heteros is making a very distinct point. This is one kind of person who bears authority teaching another kind of person, a nobody who has no authority. So the Apostle Paul is making it very clear that these teachers, religious unbelievers though they were, did a good job of exercising their authority. And they got up to teach, everybody else closed their mouths. There wasn't a lot of chit-chatting and visiting and carrying on. There was authority in that classroom. And some teachers are so rough on authority, if you're in a church service, you're not even allowed to go out to the washroom if you need to, or throw up if you have to. We won't insist on that here, however. So, Paul in verse 21 says, "You therefore, who stand in a position of authority, teaching another who has no authority," then Paul says, "Teachest thou not thyself?" And again, it's the same word teaches, is again didasko. This time, however, it's a present active infinitive. His habitual practice of teaching, active, he does the teaching, infinitive, his purpose, now in teaching. Infinitive indicates purpose, and the purpose is negative. And he uses the word ou, which is the strongest Greek negative. He says, and he's asking him a question, "Teachest thou not thyself?" Set outu, S-E-A-U-T-O-U. The religious unsaved Jew was teaching himself. in the Greek language, when you have this word ooh in a question, that tells you what the answer should be. And the answer should be yes. Whenever you have ooh, it's yes. If it had may, that would tell you that the answer is no. The Greek is beautiful. When it asks questions, it tells you what the answer should be. So here, it asks the question, do you teach yourself? And it asks in such a way that Paul is saying, you know you do, don't you? You teach yourself, don't you, is the way we would put it in English. So the religious Jew would very smugly agree to this. He would say, yes, of course. I go home and I study the Bible. When I study the Bible, I teach myself. I go out and teach others, but I also teach myself. The same authority that I use to teach my pupils in my class is the same authority I exercise toward myself. What I know and pass to them, I know to pass for myself too. Paul says, good. You're a religious instructor. You should be positive to your own instruction. You tell your pupils to do this, you should do this. You tell your pupils not to do this because it's wrong, you shouldn't do this. You teach them, you teach yourself, good. That's the way it should be. And Paul is leading him into a trap. Then he begins closing the trap. He says, thou that preachest, a man should not steal. Thou that preachest is the Greek word keruso. K-E-R-U-S-S-O. Keruso means to make a proclamation, to stand up and sound off and announce something. Now he's presenting the Jew as standing up and making a public declaration, people should not steal. This is something sort of like a person who is in a political campaign. He will want to say things that make him appear as being a supporter of what is right and being against what is wrong. So he will stand up when somebody's been doing a lot of stealing in high office. He will get up and he'll make a big issue. People should not steal. And he will make this as a public declaration. He will make a pronouncement. He will make an official statement. That will be his policy. That will reflect his position. Now that's what the Jew is doing. It is present tense, which means he was constantly proclaiming this kind of honesty. It was active. The unbelieving religious Jew himself was making this proclamation. It's participle, indicating a statement of his practice. He was constantly saying, don't steal. And he was making a public proclamation about that. The word steal is klepto. K-L-E-P-T-O. From which, of course, you can see we get kleptomaniac, a person who can't keep from stealing. The word simply means to take what belongs to another. And he says, don't steal. He uses the Greek word me, M-E. Don't steal. Present tense. This is never to be your practice. Active. You should not be guilty of a personal act of thievery. Infinitive. The purpose of this statement is to keep people from stealing. So he says, you who are standing up and preaching to people saying, do not steal. Then he asks them a question. Dost thou steal? And again he uses the word klepto. K-L-E-P-T-O. This could be read in the Greek Bible as a statement. It is better to understand it as a question. Paul is very subtly asking him a question. And he does it in this way. Paul is raising an eyebrow. And he's simply saying, do you steal? He says, you who stand up, you proclaim to the world, people should not steal. Paul says, Mr. Religious Jew, could I ask you a question? Well, of course, my good man. Do you steal? Now, he's not telling him that he steals. He's just asking him the question. This is Dirty Pool Paul doing his job of eating away, grinding away at the confidence of the religious Jew. Paul knew that the religious Jew was not above stealing. Paul knew that the religious Jew was only above letting other people know that he steals. So he asks the question, present tense, is it a regular practice with you to steal? Active voice, do you yourself act as a thief? Indicative, statement of fact. Is that a true statement? Paul is asking the question, and he knows that the answer is yes. We have several indications in the Bible that show us that the Jews were not above stealing. Many of them. In Mark chapter 12, in verse 40, we read, "Who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers, these shall receive greater condemnation." Part of the way they devoured widows' houses was to steal from the widow, to put her in a position where they could take her property at a great loss to herself, and thus, in effect, to be stealing from someone who is in a helpless position of widowhood. In Mark chapter 7, verse 11, we have, "But ye say, if a man shall say to his father or mother, it is korban, that is to say, a gift, by whatever thou mightest be profited, by me he shall be free." Korban, K-O-R-B-A-N. It's a Greek word. It's a technical word. It means a gift that is given to a religious purpose. So what the unbelieving Jew would do, he would take his property and say, "God, I dedicate everything I have to you. It is my gift to you. And I thank you that I can live off of this gift that is yours." His father and mother come along and say, "Son, we've had some hard times. Could you help us out?" And the pious, pharisaical, Jewish unbeliever would fold his hands and say, "Oh, mother and dad, I wish I could, but I have dedicated all I have to God. It's korban. I'm sorry, I couldn't give it to you. It's God. You know, I can't steal from God." But what was he doing? Well, a dirty, unbelieving Jew, he was stealing from his parents, who should have had his help, who had given him infinitely more in his life and were deserving of his consideration. Here's a subtle way in which the Jew was stealing, and yet he was standing up and proclaiming publicly, "People shouldn't steal." Now the Apostle Paul says, "Hey, fella, do you steal?" One example you have that Malachi points out to us that's very popularly known is in Malachi chapter 3, the last book of the Old Testament, beginning at verse 8, where God says, "Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, how have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in mine house. And test me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven, and pour out for you a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it." In the Old Testament, God had the system of the religious income tax. 10% was known as the tithe. And God said, "You will bring this. There is no question about it. There are no exceptions. Poor or rich, you will bring this 10%. And yet, they were holding out on God. And God says, "You've been stealing from me." And the religious, unbelieving Jews said, "How could we have been stealing from you? What do you mean, God?" And God says, "You've been stealing from me because you are supposed to bring me a certain amount of your money, and you've refused to do so." Now, I know that a lot of preachers like to use that passage and apply it to churches today, and it is a good verse. It does really move the cockles of the heart, and you can see why they're tempted to try to take that passage and put the religious income tax system on believers, but that's not legitimate. However, the principle, no doubt, involved there is legitimate, that we too, in the age of grace, who have been entrusted and are the stewards of the possessions that God has in the world. God has no possessions in this world except those that are entrusted to us. And if we do not bring to him that which he has entrusted, that part that he meant for us to give to his work, why, we're stealing just as much as the Jew of the Old Testament did. If we do not bring our offerings, we're just as much the thieves as the Jews of the Old Testament ever were. So the spiritual principle involved there is indeed applicable. So the next time you tell your children, "I don't want you stealing. You don't take things that don't belong to you," I just hope your kids won't embarrass you by saying, "Have we been giving our offering to the Lord's work that God gave us to give to the Lord's work?" Sooner or later, some of you are going to have some smart kids who are going to ask you that. There are no children here tonight, so none of them will go home and ask you that. However, it might be embarrassing if they did, if you were not playing square with God. You might have to rise up and say, "Son, don't be invading the privacy of my priesthood." You may have to fall back on that, whatever it takes. Well, you see what Paul is doing here, he's aiming at the conscience. He's aiming at the conscience of the unsaved Jew. Rather than point his finger at this fellow and say, "You're stealing," he's asking his conscience the question, because if he pointed out, if he went point blank, said, "You're a thief," this Jew would rise up like he always does in his religious indignation, say, "No, I'm not." In his mind, the religious person knows that he is a hypocrite on the matter of stealing. When Paul raises his eyebrow and said, "Do you steal?" his conscience is screaming at him, "You know you do." The religious unbeliever has been preaching that one must not steal, you see, in order to be saved. That was the point here. And the religious unbelieving Jew says, "I know I am saved because I don't steal." And Paul is going to pick three of the biggest things out of the Mosaic law. The biggest things that the religious unbelieving Jew said, "If you want to go to heaven, man, I'm going to tell you one thing. You do these three things for sure. One of them is you don't steal." And yet Paul has forced the conscience of this unbelieving Jew to admit to himself that he steals. And once he has caused him to admit that, then his confidence in his salvation is shown to be false. And that's what Paul's after. Paul has shown that the immoral man is not going to heaven. He has shown that the moral man is not going to heaven. Now he has got to show that the religious man is not going to heaven either. And he has made the first step toward this by showing this Jew, who says, "If you want to go to heaven, you don't steal." He has now shown this Jew that he is stealing. And therefore, his claim to salvation is based on a false confidence. See, all systems of religion always break down in the fact that the promoters cannot live up to their own system. All systems of religion designed for salvation by man's capacity always break down because the people who created them can't live up to their own systems. Human good is ignorantly equated with divine good. Even when they do good things, it doesn't count with God. So the illusion is created that man, with the old sin nature, can still somehow produce something good that God will accept for eternal life, because they don't know the difference between human good that comes from the old sin nature and divine good that comes from God. So the weakness in all these religious systems is that they are based on who and what the sinner is, rather than on who and what God is. Well, Paul moves on. Having made this telling blow, he picks up momentum, and he comes in with a second strike. For he asks him then, again in verse 22, he says, "Thou that sayest, a man should not commit adultery." Thou that sayest, that's the word lego, L-E-G-O, which is to declare something. It's present tense. The constant statement of the religious Jew is that if you want to go to heaven, you better not be guilty of adultery. Adultery is illicit sex, whether you are married or unmarried. The unbelieving Jew here is himself speaking out, so it's active, it's participle, it's a principle which is stated. Here, this participle has the word "the" in front of it, which makes it what grammatically is called a substantive use of the participle, or as a subject, so that the sentence really is saying the one who says, or literally, the saying not to commit adultery person. He addresses the unbelieving Jew as the saying not to commit adultery person. A man should not commit adultery. Moichuo is the Greek word. Looks like this. M-O-I-C-H-E-U-O. Moichuo, illicit sex, outside of marriage. It's present tense. It has the negative with this. You are never to do this. It's active. It is personally to be avoided. Infinitive indicates that it is God's purpose that illicit sex should not be practiced by the human race. We would translate this, "You who say that one should not commit adultery." Now you may be sure that the religious unbelieving Jew was very strong on this point. This was a big point in the Jews' legalistic system. He was very confident that if you wanted to go to heaven, brother, there's one thing you better not be guilty of, and that's illicit sex. Well, having established this, Paul then zeroes in on him with his eye-raising question again. He says, "Do you commit adultery?" And he uses again the same word, moichuo, M-O-I-C-H-E-U-O. This time, it's present tense, active, indicative. Some religious Jews were indeed overtly adulterous. That was evident. One of the favorite places that they did this was to sneak off down to the pagan temple. Any big city in the ancient world had its pagan temples. At the heart of the pagan worship was the worship of life through the practice of prostitution. So the temples had their contingent of male and female prostitutes. And it was not above some of the Jews to slip off down there to the temple to practice adultery with one of the female prostitutes. Now that was open adultery. However, for a larger number of the Jews, it was not overt. It was that category of adultery that is mentioned in Matthew 5, 27 and 28, where the Lord Jesus Christ says that a mental adultery is just as bad as an overt adultery. Let's read it. Matthew chapter 5, verse 27. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old, Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. Now here is this religious Jew who's saying that a person goes to heaven on the basis of the fact that he does not do certain things. One of them is illicit sex. And yet, when Paul asks him whether he is guilty of this, his conscience again strikes him, for he knows that to what degree he may not be outwardly guilty of this, that very frequently he was practicing it mentally. Very frequently he was going through his mental gymnastics and daydreams of illicit sex, which God says that's adultery. Even if it's an imaginative, unknown individual that is involved in your daydreams. Constant violation, present tense, active, done by the very religious person who's speaking against adultery, indicative of statement of fact about the religious unbeliever. So again, the religious Jew says, you can't be saved if you're guilty of adultery. Paul has shown him very subtly he's guilty of adultery. Therefore, Paul again has brought a serious blow against his claim to salvation, which is exactly what he's trying to do. Paul is saying, you're saying that you are not guilty of this when in effect you are. And therefore, what you are claiming is a bit of hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is always at the heart of every human man-made religious system, sooner or later. Then Paul comes through with another biggie. If there was anything that was big with the Jews, it certainly was stealing. If there was any evil that was big with the Jews, it was certainly adultery. But there was no evil so great among the Jews as that of idolatry. And so the next thing Paul takes up is this one. Thou that abhorrest idols. B-D-E-L-U-S-S-O-M-A-I. Delusomai. Delusomai. This word means to turn away from in disgust. This word means to detest. It is the word which is used when a person turns away from some kind of a stench that has reached his nostrils. Turning away from that odor is described as delusomai. This is present tense. This was constantly the attitude of the religious Jew. Personal. It was middle voice, so it was to his personal benefit. It's participle, it's a principle of morality. And what did he turn from? From eidolon. E-I-D-O-L-O-N. Eidolon. Idols. That is the image of a god. Anytime a Jew saw an image of a false god, he turned from it like he had just smelled a garbage pile ripe in the sun. It was a stench that he could not stand. There was nothing he was more fanatical about in his opposition than to idolatry. Now, it was easy enough, you see, to make this claim that if you want to go to heaven, fella, there's one thing you better not be guilty of, it's idolatry. But you see, even this is another thing, that is human capacity to please God. Human beings reaching certain levels, keeping certain rules, following certain codes in order that God will give you eternal life. Now it is true that the Jews have had their fill of idolatry following the 70 years Babylonian captivity. Up to that time, you must remember that the Jews were fantastically guilty of idolatry. Don't make the mistake of thinking that they only got into this when they were just out of the land of Egypt and Moses was getting the information on Mount Sinai, and he came down and he found that they were having a sex party and that they had set up this golden calf that they were worshiping. That was way back there, and that they had learned their lesson. Never! throughout the history of the people of Israel, they were forever establishing these groves, these high places, where the phallic cults were practiced and where the worship of the heathen was performed. Finally, when God said, I've had enough, the northern kingdom, 10 tribes, off to Assyria, and I never want to see you again until I'm ready to bring you back in the tribulation. And off they went. Finally, the 2 southern tribes, you still haven't learned your lesson, 70 years of captivity. Well, when they got back from that captivity, there was only one reaction to idolatry. It was a stench in their nose. And they genuinely, I don't care whether he was a believing Jew or an unbelieving Jew, there wasn't anything he hated more than idolatry. Now, Paul comes along and he gives them the zinger again, as he's been doing all along. And he uses this word, hierosuleo, hierosuleo. Paul says, dost thou commit sacrilege? Well, what does this word hierosuleo mean? Well, it comes from hieron. You can see that the first part. Hieron means temple, and it comes from suleo, which means to rob. So this word means to rob temples. Again, Paul raises his eyebrows and say, you hate idolatry? You who proclaim your hatred of idolatry, you who abhor as an ugly stench in your nose idolatry, do you rob temples? Now, the ancient heathen temples were not only places of good time Charlies to gather around. No offense, Charlie. They were not only the places to have a night out with the boys, but they were also what in effect we would call the banks. Because people, under the protective custody of the heathen deity to which this temple was dedicated, would bring their valuables there. And they would store their valuables. Now, the religious Jews hated idolatry, but not so much that he wouldn't contaminate himself, because the heathen temple was an unclean place. He didn't hate it so much that he was above not walking onto the unclean territory of a heathen temple and stealing what was stored there. And he would rob the temples blind if he could. He hated idolatry, but not so much as not to steal from the temple. Not so much that he couldn't take a little ceremonial uncleanness in the process. He had the same idea that a lot of Christians have today. I'm going to do a little bit of real healthy wheeling, dealing, sinning, earning money, and then I'm going to quit and be clean for the Lord from then on and help the Lord's work. This Jew did the same thing. He said, I'm going to steal a little bit from the temple. I'll get a little ceremonially unclean, but I'm going to give 10% to God's work. And everything he stole, he gave a tithe to the Lord. So when Paul says, do you rob the temple? This again was another way of undermining the Jews' confidence of his cleanness, his purity on the point of idolatry. And again, he was showing the hypocrisy of the Jew. Now, the Jew, of course, was guilty, as you know, of irreverence toward God. That could also be included in this robbing God, because, as you know, Jesus one time took a whip and drove the money changers out of the temple, and he says, you've made my father's house into a den of thieves. So here you have this combination of desecrating God's house, irreverence toward God, as well as the uncleanness of participating in stealing from heathen temples. So all human systems of salvation, you see, Paul is showing, break down because of the inconsistency of the old sin nature. All human good is at best evil with God. The covering up of this inconsistency, that you cannot live up to your own system, makes you a hypocrite. In verses 23 and 24, Paul takes up the discrediting of the name of God. Verse 23 tells about the dishonor. He says, thou that. We would say, you who. That is not a Greek greeting, but he's saying, you who make your boast. Makest thy boast is that word we've had before, kauchaomai. Kauchaomai means to glory in. Present tense, the religious Jew had a continual point of pride. Middle voice, it was to his own glory, indicative of statement of fact. You who glory in, not of, but you who glory in the law. This time, the word law, namas, does not have the word the. It's not definite. Not the law, just law. And therefore, he's referring to the Mosaic system as a system of doing things to please God, legalism. The religious Jew spoke with fervency and confidence about the necessity of obeying all points of the law, especially the moral code. And he gloried in the fact that he had the law, which spelled out what was right and what was wrong to do. So Paul says, you who glory in such a thing as a code of laws to show you what is right and wrong, through breaking the law, through is the instrument here, breaking is the Greek word parabasis, P-A-R-A-B-A-S-I-S. Parabasis is one of the words for sin in the Bible. This is the word for crossing over the line. When the defenders of the Alamo were invited to cross over that line to decide whether they would stay or seek to escape, they were being invited to perform an act of parabasis, to cross the line. And this is one of the descriptions of sin, crossing over from what is right into that which is wrong by God's standards. It is overstepping the line. So Paul says, through overstepping the line of what? Of the law, the Mosaic law, dishonorest thou, itimazo, is the way it looks in the Greek, A-T-I-M-A-Z-O. Itimazo means to treat shamefully, to insult. By stepping across the line drawn by the Mosaic law on all of these things, stealing, adultery, idolatry, do you treat God shamefully, present tense, continually, active voice, you, the Jew, doing it yourself, indicative of statement of fact? Again, the question implies an affirmative answer. The religious Jew, by what he was doing, was discrediting God. He was pretending to be one thing, and he was a hypocrite to the core because he was practicing the very things he proclaimed others should not do, and that he declared he abhorred himself. Then Paul ties it up in verse 24. Paul says, for, introducing the reason, Greek word is gar, G-A-R, the name, the onoma, O-N-O-M-A, referring to the person of God, is blasphemeo. And you know what that means. B-L-A-S-P-H-E-M-E-O, blaspheme, to speak contemptuously of deity, to slander God. Present tense, constant result of the religious Jews' hypocrisy. Passive voice, God receives this slander, indicative of statement of fact. This slander is among, and the word in the Greek is and, so it should be in the midst of, the Gentiles, the ethnos, E-T-H-N-O-S. What the Jew did caused the Gentiles to slander and to speak blasphemously of the living God. You see, these people who were unbelievers were not as inane as the religionist Jew. Through, dishonorest thou God. Through, dia is the word, dishonoring God through you. That is through the Jew himself because of what he's doing. And then Paul adds the fact that this is not new to God. He says, just as, or katos in the Greek, K-A-T-H-O-S, it is written, grapho, G-R-A-P-H-O. Grapho refers to the written scriptures, as it is written in the scriptures concerning you Jews. He is referring to Isaiah chapter 52 and verse 5. Here's where it is written. Isaiah 52:5 says, now therefore, what have I here, saith the Lord, that my people are taken away for nothing? They that rule over them make them to wail, saith the Lord, and my name continually every day is blasphemed. The very rulers of the people were causing the name of God to be blasphemed. The religious Jew gained nothing but utter contempt for God. Now you see, the unbelieving Jew that we've described here to you this evening is in a certain category of human beings who throughout history have made up certain codes, certain rituals, certain ceremonies in order to gain divine approval, salvation. The Jew got his system from the Mosaic Law. But that legalism was no better than the heathen who didn't get theirs from the Mosaic Law. But these systems always have one thing in common, you will notice. The systems today, as any ancient system, of making it on your own with God. All these systems are encased in a sense of penance and in the concept, therefore, of do-goodism. Penance and do-goodism. One of the American clergymen who recently attended the last Congress of the World Council of Churches got up to the disgust even of many other liberals, and he made a speech before the World Council of Churches Assembly. He's an American. And he made a speech that, in effect, apologized for the fact that he was born white, that he was born Protestant, that he was born well off with money, and that he spoke the English language. He was just so ridden with guilt complex, he was just about as big an idiot and as inane a thing as you could imagine. Why was he talking like that? Well, the poor simpleton is so shot through with guilt complexes because he does not know the Lord, obviously, in genuine salvation, that he feels he must be intimidated over the fortunate circumstances of life in which he was born. He was so moved over the fact that he spoke English, which is the commercial language of the world and which everybody wants to know. Wherever you go, somebody knows English. He was so humiliated by that that he said, "I'm going to finish the rest of my discourse in Spanish," which of course made the Spaniards feel good, you know. "I'm going to use a contemptuous language to wash out my guilt." And the reporter who wrote the article said he finished his lecture, his discourse, in third-rate Spanish in order to fully cleanse his soul. Now that sort of thing, you see, is at the heart of the religious system that says, "I'm going to make it on the basis of something that I create as the standards that I keep. I'm shot through with guilt complexes, and so I'm going to express it in do-goodism," which is, of course, at the heart, the bleeding heart of the liberal mentality today. And this is finding expression all over the great and wonderful American political and economic system. It is the same expression in those areas that Paul alerted us to here in religious realms. All of this effort to honor God, and yet Paul says you've ended up dishonoring God and you've caused the heathen to spit on God. All of your efforts to be religious have created nothing but dishonor on your part and blasphemy, contempt on the part of others. You may read on your own Matthew 23, verses 13 through 36. Matthew 23, 13 through 36, which will give you a very accurate first-hand illustration from the lips of the Lord Jesus himself as to what these religious, unbelieving Jews were just really like. It is a terrible thing to be a religious unbeliever. The religious unbeliever has a hard time realizing how totally unacceptable he is to God. Stop being a hypocrite. Let God enable you to live up to what you profess. That's the only way you're going to do it.